Hi, Women of Strength. Before we jump into today's episode, I just wanted to share something that's really close to my heart. If you're planning a VBAC or even just starting to think about one, you don't have to piece everything together on your own. You don't have to find every blog or hunt down a specific podcast episode. The VBAC Link Parent Prep Course was created by our founders, Julie and Megan, who are doulas and VBAC moms themselves. I actually took it when I was preparing for my own VBAC, long before I was a host of the podcast, just as a mom who needed clarity, confidence, and evidence-based information. So I can say, from a personal standpoint, that I know you'll love it. We also have a VBAC birth plan guidebook with a drag and drop template, and that's the exact template I used for my own VBAC birth. It made communicating with my care team so much more smooth. So if you're looking for practical, supportive VBAC prep from people who truly get it, you can find both the course and the guidebook at thevbaclink.com. All right, let's get into today's episode.
Welcome to the VBAC Link podcast. I am your host, Paige, and it's just me flying solo today. I'm missing Lily. I'm feeling empty without her, but I am wearing my Colorado sweatshirt in honor of her and the headband, so I feel like she's here with us. And we have Mags today from South Africa. Welcome to the show, Mags.
Aw, thank you so much, Paige.
We're so happy to have you here. I was looking at our history of episodes, and we are now on episode 442, and our only, if I have this right, our only other South African a podcast from South Africa was Danielle back in the 180s. And also, Mags is going to be sharing a very special VBAM story with us, two stories with us, actually. And that stands for vaginal birth after myomectomy. We also only have one other story of a myomectomy on the podcast, and that was Mabel, only a few episodes after Danielle, actually, back in 2022. Wow. Yeah, so that's kind of a funny little way that that all worked out. But I remember Mabel's episode specifically. I was back in the transcribing world, and I was transcribing her episode. It was so powerful. So many quotes. And actually, in her submission form, Mags mentioned that she was able to connect with Mabel a little bit. And I was like, is that our Mabel?
And it then, was from your podcast, yeah.
Oh, I love it so much. So I can't wait to hear more about that and how you two connected. So I'll read a little bit about Mags so we can get to know her better. And then we will jump into a review of the week. And I cannot wait to dive into her stories. There's so much that you will learn from her and her stories. So this was going to be an episode that you will put on repeat and listen to over and over, I have no doubt. All right, so Maria Magdalena Mags Campbell is a Cape Town-based artist, brand and UX designer, a mother of two, and a passionate advocate for informed, empowered birth. After a challenging fertility journey, including two miscarriages, fibroid surgery, a failed IUI, and declining IVF, she naturally conceived her son and persisted through eight doctors before finding support for her hospital VBAM, which she achieved with an epidural at 9 centimeters. Her second conception came easily, followed by a smooth pregnancy and an unmedicated hospital birth of her daughter. Mags shares her story to highlight resilience, self-trust, and the importance of compassionate, evidence-based care. So it's so amazing. I cannot wait. I will read this review very quickly, and this review today comes from Facebook. And if you didn't know, you can leave reviews both on Apple Podcasts and on Facebook. Our Facebook reviews are very, very old, so we would love some updated ones from you all, and then maybe we'll have them read on the podcast. But this one today comes from Sarah Winters. She says, I am currently preparing for my TOLAC next month and listen to the VBAC Link podcast on my nightly walks. My birth with my first was an emergency C-section in a different birthing location than planned with strangers after over 32 hours of labor. While physical recovery was in general not all that bad, the whole experience definitely left me somewhat defeated with some lasting trauma and anxiety surrounding birth. Listening to Megan and Julie, if you're new to the podcast, those are our original co-hosts, as well as hearing other women openly share their hearts and stories has helped me connect with and process my own emotions better. It has left me feeling far less alone. It has also been uplifting and encouraging to hear other women's success stories, both VBAC and CBAC. The practical advice and information, including positional tips, statistics on rupture, and many other little gems, have been so helpful in keeping me grounded and helping me feel well-informed and prepared. Thank you so much for this resource. I feel that mental and emotional preparation is even more important than physical in many cases when it comes to birth after an unplanned or traumatic first experience. The podcast and resources in the blog have greatly contributed to my preparation in those areas, and regardless of how my upcoming birth goes, I am so grateful for that. We're so grateful for you. So thankful that this resource helped you. And Sarah, if you're still out there listening, we would love to hear how your birth went. So send us an email.
Hi, I'm Lily.
And I'm Paige. Welcome to the VBAC Link podcast.
We're moms and doulas who know firsthand that birth after cesarean isn't always straightforward. I'm a miscarriage and ectopic mom who went on to have a hospital water birth VBAC.
And I've had two CBACs and a planned maternal assisted cesarean.
Our experiences may be different, but our mission is the same: to make birth after cesarean better.
On this podcast, you'll hear powerful stories of VBACs, repeat cesareans, and CBACs from women around the world.
We'll also bring in expert insight, practical tools, and encouragement to help you feel informed and supported as you plan your next birth.
Whether you're preparing for a VBAC, choosing a repeat cesarean, or simply exploring your options, this space is for you.
Because every story matters, and we're here to remind you that you've got options, you've got support, and you're never alone.
The VBAC Link is storytelling by nature. The stories on this podcast do not represent a universally best or safest option for everyone.
This podcast is intended to encourage and inform. It does not replace individualized advice from a qualified medical provider.
Okay, welcome back. And without further ado, I would love to turn the time over to Max.
Hello, and thank you so much just for having me on. I think when I was going through my whole process, I found Mabel, as you mentioned, on your podcast. And it was the only person that I could find on the internet, and I looked everywhere, to talk about a VBAM. And she actually mentioned in her podcast that it's not about boasting, it's not about trying to win a medal for achieving vaginal birth. It's really for anyone else. If you do achieve a VBAM, it's for anyone else like me who was struggling to find the right information. When doctors were giving you false information and false statistics to be able to find you. And after connecting with her, and yeah, she's probably one of the main reasons I actually managed to do this. So promised myself at some point I will get onto some platform if I had a chance. And it popped up recently, and I was about to give birth to my second. So I was like, oh, let me just submit. And here we are. So thank you so much for your podcast. I listen to a lot of podcasts when I'm pregnant, especially. And my first pregnancy, it was my third pregnancy, but the first viable one, I listened to a lot of the VBAC Link to try and get as much information as possible. So we'll start at the beginning. Definitely not the happiest start, but so many women go through it. And I think it's so amazing that more and more women are speaking a bit more openly about miscarriage. It does make it a lot less lonely for those going through it. So my first pregnancy was in 2020. That I was so excited and so naive, and yeah, never ever felt an immediate love like that in my entire life. That baby was as real to me as the two babies that are in my house right now. He had a name. We were very excited. But unfortunately, at 12 weeks, it was a missed miscarriage. So we had to kind of grieve through that. It was in 2020 with COVID. I went into full-blown PTSD, but was trying to hide it because I think miscarriage is very misunderstood. So you almost feel ashamed of the level of grief you are going through, and no one else is grieving. So it's not like cancer, or it's not like the death of a mom or a physical child where other people loved that child as much as you did, or your mom. Everyone kind of understands that. Not a lot of people understand the level of grief of miscarriage. So that was a very, very difficult time. And then we struggled to conceive again. I'll mention in that first sort of the scans post-miscarriage, they picked up a small fibroid, and I'm assuming it kind of developed post the pregnancy. I never had it before. So that was the first mention of the word fibroid. I'd never heard of it, and the doctors were very unconcerned about it. So then we tried to conceive again. I kind of felt if I could just fall pregnant again, everything would be okay and I'd be happy again. And then I didn't. And it was then devastating when, you know, every period almost becomes a miscarriage because you're expecting it and you're so scared. And at the time, I was pregnant with about 17 other people I knew within the same week. I think it was there was like a COVID baby spread. And it was very difficult to sort of watch everyone give birth eventually, and I still wasn't pregnant. But I dealt with it as best as I could, and eventually worked with a dietitian who I knew had miscarried as well, and just to try and sort out everything I could control. And we fell pregnant again pretty much within a few days of the first time we found out that we were pregnant. So to me, I was like, God has given me a second chance to see how amazing pregnancy can be. And it's the same timeline. And I was so excited. And same thing. It was another miscarriage. This one I found out on my birthday, the morning of my birthday. And we had the most incredible birthday night planned at Babylon Sturin, where I was to create content for them. It was an absolute disaster. I was so hysterical that morning. I think when you have two miscarriages a year apart, then you have to really start asking yourself some hard questions, because that's not an accident. That's not just there's something going wrong and no one knows what. And that actually becomes very stressful in itself. But I put a smile on my face and put my work boots on and went and smiled at cameras while I was hiding a miscarriage.
Poor thing.
That was a very, very low point in my life. And I laugh about it now, but it's hysterical. It's a hysterical laugh. I don't think I ever really dealt with a second miscarriage because I'd also chosen to like not tell anyone except immediate family. And not all family members are well equipped to deal with your miscarriage either. So they unknowingly, unfortunately, cause a lot more harm than they realize. And yeah, to open that up to more people actually just becomes a bit, you're too vulnerable at that point. So I sort of just hid it and pretended nothing was happening. So then I had a hysteroscopy scheduled. In the second pregnancy, my fibroids grew rapidly. They went from very minor to like 3-4 centimeters, and they were multiple now. So obviously the hormones in the pregnancy just sort of skyrocketed their size. But again, all doctors said they're not in any placement that's worrying them. It's not causing the miscarriages. They didn't suggest anything further. I saw a multitude of doctors at this point. So we did a hysteroscopy and they found inflammation in my lining. I think it's weird going in for these things because you don't want to find something, because then essentially you're finding the reason both your babies had died, and it's your body. And it's a very weird thing when your body's killing your babies and you're not in control of it, obviously. But then it's just a strange that operation was a strange mix of emotions for me, because I want them to find something because then we can fix it. But I also don't want them to find anything because then I have to blame my body, and it's already, there's like a difficult relationship being formed with the body now. They did find inflammation, but they said it could be just due to the miscarriage. It's not necessarily the cause of it. So we just went on trying. It was a very, very difficult 2 years. And yeah, no luck. Eventually, I just said to my husband, I actually can't be in this infertility loop of the devastation. I just want to follow a different dream. Not putting this on the back burner, but I was like, let's move to New York and go live there and work for a bit. It's like a big dream of mine always. So I said, let's go see a fertility doctor because I want to have all the checks done before we like head overseas. And if we fall pregnant there naturally at some point, then, you know, we can always move back. And I need to not be the miscarriage girl at this point, or the girl not falling pregnant and everyone's having babies. And it's my greatest wish, but I can't. So I went to a fertility doctor for the first time, like a proper fertility specialist. They came highly recommended on their profile. They also had this surgeon's wife was supposedly some form of a grief counselor for people suffering miscarriage, which that's the reason why I chose them, because I was struggling so much emotionally. It was an absolute disaster. the worst place. I would not send my greatest enemy there. But anyway, I'm grateful that it was the worst, because the story worked out. So I'm grateful you kind of see in hindsight 2020, you can see why certain things didn't work out. But anyway, so I went to this doctor. The first appointment, we just said we just want general checks done for, like, cover all our bases. And I spoke to him about the fibroids, and he said, it was very strange. He said, I must not go tell everyone that he's suggesting just surgery because he's a surgeon. I was like, but you didn't suggest that, so why would I tell anyone that? So he said, no, the fibroids are no issue. They're not in any place. They're not causing miscarriages. They're not causing, like, delayed conception. We can leave it. I had another appointment scheduled 2 weeks later. And 2 weeks later, it was hugely urgent. We had to schedule it immediately. We couldn't delay. I mean, it was within that month. We had to cancel holiday plans. Like, it was just immediate, and it was very overwhelming. I was like, if I asked a question, he was like, no, I know. If I was his daughter, this is the recommendation he would give. So I was just, you know, it was very much like a sausage factory. I was a number, and he couldn't even remember my number. And then I was carted off to his wife, and now I'm in shock, because he was also quite honest that it was a very painful operation. Now I'm in shock because I'm like, oh wow, I came in for some blood tests and now I'm having major surgery. Oh, and his wife was, so I started saying, I was very upset, I was crying, I'm scared, and now I'm a bit overwhelmed. And she told me to stop talking, because we really needed to focus on my husband's emotions. And I was like, are you joking? My husband hasn't even been poked. Is this real? Is this happening? I think I was so shocked. I didn't even say, I was like, oh, okay. Let's give Sean a minute to like discuss his emotions. I don't even think he had done a blood test. So I was like, what? Like, yes, we should focus on that man, but I don't think this is the time. Anyway, I was hysterical. I was good girl, smiled and nodded while we discussed Sean's emotions about our fertility journey and my operation. But it's anyway.
Wild.
No, you can't even make this stuff up. It's just, and the more people I speak to, the more they have the same experience. Which I am so sad I didn't do. I spoke to a friend of mine over the weekend who had the same experience, and she just yelled at this woman. She just yelled at her and
no,
left.
We're not
and
doing that.
Wrote it. Yeah, no, that's not happening. And I was like, oh, I wish I had had that reaction, you know? Like, you sit in the car and you think of, you're just so shocked. And I think it's, again, when you're going through infertility, I had a lot of people close to me who were telling me to not grieve. Like, I was told, like, word by word by someone, why can't I just find joy in someone else close to me's pregnancy? And I was like, I do find joy that they're pregnant, but I'm also grieving the death of my children. So I can't make that go away for you to make your life easier. I'm just going through grief. I think I was so grateful for the people. My cousin held such space for me. She was pregnant. And the moment people hold space for you, you go to the baby shower, you can show up. Moment someone says, my cousin said to me, Mags, I'm so proud of you for being here. I can imagine just how hard this is. And I was like, oh, thank you. Just for, you know, if I got baby shower invites, and the few people who knew were obviously close to me, and all of them would say, bar one, which I didn't end up going to, all of them would say, don't worry about coming. You know, your mental health is far greater than one day. We can celebrate separately. Don't worry about coming. And I was like, no, the moment someone says that, you go, no, I'm coming. Because if I start crying hysterically, you'll know why. And I know that person won't take offense or think I'm making it about me. And I could easily go there. And yeah, I mean, like, your heart sort of aches a bit, but you can really hold space for someone else's pregnancy and be very close to that person, where just if they hold space for you and your just horrifying journey. that's going alongside them. And that's amazing lessons that I learned in empathy that I can apply in my own life. So very grateful for learning that stuff. Unfortunately, you learn that the hard way. And I think you also have to learn how to hold, just to have grace for the people who didn't do it perfectly and who did cause a lot of harm, because they don't mean it. They really don't mean any harm. But I think it's, yeah, it's valuable lessons in life, especially as a mom. So it's valuable lessons to learn. But anyway, I'm getting sidetracked. So I had the hysteroscopy. Fertility doctor was rushed into this myomectomy. My first question to him was, would I be able to give vaginal birth after this? Because I had this dream of a home birth. I had had the home birth doctor. And from my first pregnancy, I was so excited. I mean, I'd been pregnant twice. So I'd done a lot of research and prep. And I had this dream. And this was really, bit of a damper on that dream. But anyway, he said it just depends on how the surgery goes and it depends on the pregnancy itself. So I was like, okay, there's still hope, you know. Rushed into the surgery. That surgery, he did not prepare me for the true pain of it. I spoke to a friend of mine who had a similar surgery a month before, and she didn't tell me just the amount of pain, because she said she didn't want that stuck in my head and that I sort of had the same pain just because she had mentioned it. But I woke up from that surgery screaming. Like, I have a very high pain threshold. I was screaming hysterically, and I was screaming for my husband. I was so overwhelmed. Oh, no, I cry. But the nurse wouldn't let my husband in. It was just, there was so much trauma. And I don't know why I'm crying. This is so long ago. Must be the newborn hormones. Eventually, they had to overdose me on morphine because I was just so hysterical, and my husband couldn't bring them in. Anyway, then the recovery from that surgery started, which was awful. It was a very, very difficult recovery.
Taking a quick break from our episode to share this important stat with you. Did you know a 2025 retrospective cohort study published in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology found that doula care was associated with about a 15.6 increase in VBAC rates compared to those without doula support? Lily and I love doulas, and we are doulas. The VBAC Link was founded by doulas Julie Frankham and Megan Heaton, who created a comprehensive VBAC course for doulas. It's fully self-paced, completely virtual, and when you complete it, you're added to the VBAC Link doula directory. You'll also earn 8 ICEA continuing education hours and become a VBAC certified doula. And if you're a parent looking for a VBAC Link certified doula, you can find one at thevbaclink.com/findadoula. All right, let's get back to the episode.
And the first question, the doctor came into the hospital room. I had like a bedpan under me. It was hysterical. I was like, this is just the worst moment. It's like the most humbling moment of your life. Anyway, the doctor came in, and before he opened his mouth, I was like, how did the surgery go? Can I give vaginal birth? And he said, there's no reason based on the surgery for me not to do it, but we do need to see how long past the surgery, you know, how long in between the surgery and the birth, and just see again how the pregnancy itself goes for various reasons. So I was hopeful. Anyway, then I was in the sausage factory, and I was just so desperate at this point to be pregnant. So I was like, let's do an IUI. I just need to speed up this process. I'm just so over the trauma, and I just need my baby now. And a friend of mine and my cousin had such great success with IUIs, so I wanted to try it. I'd also, a friend of mine sent me a link to a fertility coach. She was starting out, and she wanted to interview people going through infertility. So I spoke to her, and that was just mind-blowing. Her name's Kelly Lynch. She is just, I think I spoke to her for an hour, and she could uncover things about my personality that like my personal therapist in 5 years could not uncover. Like she just opened my eyes to who I am as a person, which was really funny. And she started this fertility coaching course, and we were sort of the, in Afrikaans you say, the proefkonyne. We were like the the testers. So I think it was a group of 8 or 9 of us, and that was life-changing because I all of a sudden had women in the same position as me that I could meet with once a month. And we were doing this amazing course and we were learning all about the spiritual side of infertility and how a lot of type A women struggle specifically with infertility and unexplained infertility and how meditation and the mind-body connection and your fears. And so that's, she kind of said it's like you can do it alongside fertility treatment, but she almost believes that you can sort your body, your own body out and be pregnant naturally. So I started working with her alongside the fertility doctor. I had one IUI. And the doctor, so this was a very big deal for us. We were so excited. And we went in, I was recording everything because, you know, you're trying to make it special because obviously there's not, it's not very romantic being inserted. But but the doctor walked in and he's like, oh, so this is your second one. And I was like, wow, like you didn't even read the chart. Like just take 2 seconds to read the chart and make this like you actually know my name, you know. Anyway, the IUI failed, and then I was like, oh my word, fertility treatment's not working. And I think the fear for me with IVF was, that's everyone's last resort, and what if it fails? And then where do you go? Anyway, generally people suggest 3 to 4 IUIs before going to IVF. I had been pregnant twice before, so my problem wasn't really in conception. It was more in miscarriage, like in the first trimester, something was going wrong. So I didn't really understand why we would do IVF, how that would stop the miscarriage, because we hadn't figured out the root cause yet. We went into, so he went straight, no, we can't do any more IUIs. I have to do IVF. And then I was like, you're such an ass. Like, I hate you. I'm a number to you. You could not care less about me or my journey. You don't even listen to me when I say, I think we need to figure out what's causing the miscarriage before we go to IVF. And because I'm pretty sure my body can create life. I'm struggling to keep it. So I just said no, I declined, I left it. So in that sense, I'm very grateful that he was such an ass because I left and my journey from then was just so much better. So we took our savings and went to the Maldives because now it had been already a year after the last miscarriage and so much had happened. And I was like, people say go on a holiday and you'll fall pregnant. So I was like, this is the best holiday you could go on. And there was a COVID special. So we went and I had my birthday there, which I could grieve in private of the year mark of that miscarriage and try and just celebrate as well, celebrate life while grieving everything we're going through. I didn't fall pregnant, which I was horrified about. But anyway, through the fertility course, I had completely 100% accepted that I was going to fall pregnant at some point. And every month became less and less traumatic for me. And I think that was the key for me to actually fall pregnant, like allow my body to fall pregnant, because there's just so much fear before. So I fell pregnant again at the end of that year. So my myomectomy was in the beginning of the year, fell pregnant, found out late November, and then obviously went straight into, I actually then from research, I requested progesterone. No one had ever mentioned it to me before. I don't know why, but I just asked for it. I was like, I'm throwing Western, Chinese, everything. So I went to an acupuncturist that's an hour away, once a week, Chinese medicine, progesterone. There was blood on the first scan, but our first heartbeat ever. So we were so stressed because of the blood, and we were like, but there's a heartbeat. So we're excited, but we're like so stressed. Very interesting mix of emotions, because you want to celebrate, but you also like don't get too happy. But it was a viable pregnancy for once. And we just had tons of scans to make sure everything was progressing. And by the 12-week mark, all of my fears had kind of gone, because that was I'd surpassed the longest amount of time. How do I say this? My first miscarriage was at 12 weeks. I was 12 weeks pregnant. So when I got past that 12-week mark, I was like, okay, we're good. We're in the clear. We had the fetal assessment and we were good. Easy pregnancy, except baby was breached. So I did all the inversions, everything, moxibustion, everything. And eventually had to do an ECV. Luckily, I was with a doctor that would do it. the doctor journey, I was with a doctor and in South Africa to give vaginal birth in private care is incredibly difficult. A lot of doctors will say they like pro-natural, and then they'll tell you, oh, it's a big baby, you can't, or oh, it's a big head and you can't, or there's always some reason at the end that they kind of come up with. But because I'd had the surgery, I was even in a worse position. And through a lot of questions, and with my doctor at the time, such a lovely man, he eventually said to me, Mags, don't give birth at this hospital. It's a mediclinic in Paul. And he was like, just, this is not your hospital. Because for a lot of that journey, the surgeon was blocking me. Every doctor that would contact him, he would say, no, I'm not a candidate. And I knew for a fact he didn't even open my file. He just said no. And then eventually my doctor got hold of my surgical notes. And he actually kindly gave it to me so that I could read it and get more opinions on it. And I spoke to doctors, found Mabel through this podcast. And then I looked her up on Instagram, DM'd her, and she just sent me a wealth of medical research. And it's honestly, it's less risk than a VBAC if there's certain criteria met. So that's why it's so important to have your surgical notes. So I had a few big intramural and subserosal fibroids, meaning they in the muscular wall of the uterus and on the outside. So the cavity was never breached, which that's one thing that's important. The second thing is not near the fundus. That's another thing that's important. And it was laparoscopic. That's important because they can also kind of do it like a C-section where they open you up and then you have less chance of being a good candidate. So I met all the criteria and I had to really educate myself for a couple of months, worked with a doula who was really supporting me in this. And I went through 8 doctors who just said no based on the surgeon. Then eventually I took the surgeon on. And I said, based on the notes, I've met with multiple doctors and no one can say based on the notes that I'm not a good candidate. Anyway, eventually he said, well, you can, it's similar to a VBAC, but it depends on your appetite for risk. Now, keeping in mind, I'm like self-educating here and scared. I've lost 2 babies. I don't want to fight for a vaginal birth and lose a baby. Like that's the last thing. So every doctor is telling me, oh, your appetite for risk. The one doctor said I had a 9% chance of uterine rupture. Completely false.
9%?
It's literally less than 9%. Completely false. Gosh. It's less than 1%. And generally, the uterine rupture doesn't actually happen in birth. It happens before. It's not in the pushing or so. And there's also things you can do. But anyway, this I had to find out for myself. I had a research folder. I printed out 2 copies, highlighted it. I went to one last doctor at 32 weeks pregnant. And I went in and I'd studied everything and I was going to really politely take her on. She was supposedly very VBAC friendly. So that's why I went to her. Anyway, I never even had to open the file. She found it very comical. But anyway, she was very up to date with the research. She was so confident that I could be confident. I was like, okay, I find someone that's confident. I can be confident. And I'm going to be at the hospital. I declined any form of induction because Pitocin, from what I understand, makes a more aggressive contraction, which generally you'll need an epidural to just get through the contractions. It's also unnatural contractions. So any of that stuff I didn't want on my uterus, especially not for a long time. I wanted to avoid an epidural as far as possible, just so I could feel if there was a rupture. So those are just the types of things that I had researched. I knew I could go over my due date because a lot of doctors say you're not allowed to. I knew I could, based on the research, I could. The size of the baby doesn't make a difference. And I did go over my due date, actually. Anyway, we had that birth. We had the ECV, which was really painful, but I think it's less painful than a C-section. And after my myomectomy, I really did not want a surgery. I didn't want anyone cutting me open. Yeah, I went into first birth with my son. My water broke around 12 o'clock. We had to go into the hospital because I was a bit more risky for them. So we went through, it's very far from us. So we drove through, there was a taxi strike. So it was understaffed at the time. It was very misty. Anyway, we went there. They wouldn't let us go. which initially the doctor said, no, just come in for a check and then leave, because I'm not in active, I'm not in labor at all. They just wanted to check everything's fine. So there's a bit of miscommunication. My husband's father had a flat that was open closer to where this hospital was. So we said we had access to that, and we said we'd go birth there, or like labor there, not to have to drive back, but then woke up to construction. There was literally construction above us. So it was just a complete, everything went wrong. So there was no peace. But I didn't really feel the contractions. Eventually I said, let's go back to the hospital because it's more peaceful than here. They could measure the contractions, but I didn't really feel the contractions until much later, say at about 3 o'clock that afternoon. So then I was laboring. My doula came. Doulas are amazing. She's doing all the amazing things. We labored in like this cubicle of a loo, switched the lights off. I was on the loo and we were laughing and I could really manage it in there. But the moment I went back into the room, I really struggled. My labor was very long. It wasn't very long. It's just the active labor part became very long. I think my contractions were about a minute and a half long, very, very intense with a 30-second break, but my body couldn't relax in the 30 seconds for it to be any form of a break. And at one point they said, okay, it's about 3 hours left. And after 3 hours they came and they're like, oh, okay, it's about 3 hours left. And I was like, okay, no, I need medication. I was like, I'm not coping. Couldn't empty my bladder, which apparently also can cause it to stall. So the anesthesiologist was rushed in. And she did the epidural, she administered for me. That was the most traumatic part for me of the whole birth, because you have to sit bent forward and they're like, you have to be very still with these hectic contractions that I was struggling with for 3 hours without having to sit still. So that I was drooling on my husband. I was just screaming this black crime. It was just horrible. But once the epidural was in, I was like, this is great. But my doula put a peanut ball in between my legs to keep it open, but the epidural hadn't taken full effect yet, so it caused the half of my body to be still completely in pain. So then they had to up it, which meant I was completely dead, where now I know there's so many different ways you could do it. So I had to do like purple pushing. It was really weird, but the physical part I can do, I didn't mind it. I still loved the birth. I don't know how I achieved a vaginal birth with everything I had to go through. So I was very excited about the birth still, but I did cause a bit of damage. I had to have an episiotomy and my bladder was quite affected after that birth to the point of needing an operation. But anyway, I was just so grateful because, I mean, the C-section was booked. Like they had it, they had the theater booked because things weren't progressing. So just that I could do that, and I was so proud. I was so excited. And I finally had this like miracle boy of mine. And yeah, then the second time around, conception was very easy. I do believe I had hormonal issues before that was solved. And I was not under any form of stress or fear of falling pregnant this time, which I think combined, because hormonally, my fibroids, so after I gave birth, they could see small fibroids. And since then, they've completely disappeared. So I think there was a hormonal issue that through birth and postpartum, and I think breastfeeding and whatever I did, I eat a lot more, that could be it. My hormones were completely like solved, if that, I don't know how to, I don't really know how to say that. So I felt pregnant very easily and had a very easy pregnancy. Again, I think hardest part, having a toddler and being pregnant, that's pretty much the hardest part about pregnancy the second time around. And you get a lot bigger, a lot quicker. But yeah, no breech baby. Oh, I was just, I didn't have to. Now I could do a home birth if I wanted to, because you're allowed. But yay. Unfortunately, yes, I was so excited, but I couldn't. So the reason I didn't end up doing it is the doctor I wanted, she's not compatible with my medical aid. So I would literally have to change to a different medical aid. And I've been on my medical aid for, I think, like 30 years. So it was just a lot of admin. And the backup doctor is at the Paul Mediclinic. And if for whatever reason you have to have a C-section, that's not the place where you want to have a C-section, because they don't put baby on chest. They don't do delayed cord clamping. They take you away from your child for 40 minutes plus. So that's not where I want a C-section. The hospital that I chose for the first birth, they do gentle C-sections. It's just the norm. So it's really important what hospital you are connected with. There was a second midwife that I tried and she never got back to me. But then I'd heard bad stories about her, so I wasn't keen. And then there was a third one I checked and she only had a year experience. And again, the backup doctor was at Paul. And I was like, I'm going to stick to my doctor. I did enjoy my birth and I'm going to really pray for certain things to go a bit better. So I did a lot of, I prepared very differently this time. I got a different doula that is far more experienced, but specifically experienced with that hospital. So she knows everyone and they trust her and it was a different vibe. Like this, the last birth, there were so many people in and out because of, you know, high risk or whatever. This time we barely saw anyone. It was the three of us. And that's really how you want to give birth. So we prayed a lot about how the birth would go. I listened to a lot of birth podcasts about how to have a medical, how to have a sort of a good birth in a hospital setting. So I did a lot of preparation very differently because now you're done it once, especially at the hospital, and you kind of know what you didn't like and what you can sort of try and change this time. So I did a lot of meditation. Joe Dispenza and I went on a retreat. It's an amazing retreat where you do meditation, yoga. I did a lot of women's circle, cacao ceremonies. So I prepared very differently this time. I prepared my mental game. And I think that's pretty much what you need to be able to relax your body. And on the retreat I went on with the breathing techniques I was doing for meditation, I could get my body to do full body shivers. I don't know what to call it. There must be a name for it. But from head to toe, you have like this sort of tingles, if that makes sense. I think it's when you go from fight or flight. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I could start doing that. And I started practicing that at home. It was really nice. And with my new doula, I did massages with her. So I did almost weekly massages at one point. I relaxed my body as far as I could. So this labor, I was overdue. It was very hot. I was very big. My mom and I went on a walk that we got super lost. It was 35 degrees. We had no water. And I was quite stressed. It ended up being 8 kilometers in like pole heat. I think it was 36. And then I finally lost my mucus plug. So I'm like, okay, good. Terrible hike, but lost the mucus plug. And I was my appointment was coming up with the doctor and I was getting nervous that they were going to talk induction. I really didn't want any form of induction. And then went that night. So it was very similar to my first birth. I think 10:30, my water broke. I was about to go to bed. So I heard a little pop. And I was like, oh, I think my water just broke. And I went to the loo. I was like, cool. But last time it took really long. So I was like, messaged my doula. And I was like, let's just see what happens. Because I don't want to go to the hospital. I just want to try and get some sleep first. But so she was like, just track it for an hour, see what happens. I was like, it's so difficult. Those early contractions are so hard to track because they're not overly painful. It kind of just feels like a period cramp. Anyway, so I started tracking the period cramps and now I trained so hard for this to be less painful. So you're also like, oh, how do I know? Because you don't want it to be too painful, but anyway, you have to track it. But I think by 12, they were 5 minutes apart. So we were like, let's go to the hospital because we live far away again. And the one thing I just do not want a car maybe because South Africa is incredibly dangerous and I don't want to be on the side of a highway giving birth in the early morning hours. Especially, I think my husband would freak out the most. But we went to the hospital and I was 4 centimeters. I lay in the back of it. So I was chatting on WhatsApp at this point. By the time we got in the car, I lay on the back seat with my pregnancy pillow. I was very scared of the car ride specifically because I've heard that could be very painful. So I had AirPods, put on a birth playlist. I forgot to mention, I started that evening with a women's circle cacao ceremony and yoga class. And I was like, this is the perfect time to go to labor because you're so zen. Anyway, so I was so zen and I could breathe. So I had about 40 minutes in the back of the car to practice breathing and like really concentrating on how to get these contractions not to hurt as well, not to overwhelm me in pain. And by the time we got to the hospital, I was like, okay, I've got this. Like this, I figured out my own body. We had to walk quite far in, but it was fine. I know walking does actually help. So I was like, it's fine. Let's do this. That's probably more painful than when you can concentrate. I was 4 centimeters. They checked me. I wanted to get in the birth tub. And they had to check me for quite a while because the baby's heart rate wasn't going up and down. It was just kind of staying in one level. So they were like, is she asleep? She pretty much slept through the whole birth, which is still what she's doing. The girl was just very chill. So clearly all of my meditations had an effect on her. So the birth tub was red. The water was red and then was gray. It was so gross. So we had to go to a different. So that part was painful because now you're like out of your zone. Eventually we got the tub and I just had the most incredible. I could really ease myself into the contractions. Unlike last time, there was a genuine pause in between the contractions. So I knew, I was like, you know, you get to the edge of it. Like it's sort of like a wave and you get, okay, this is the most painful. I know it's about to come down in there. Okay, we're good, you know? So I could really like get myself through it. Then I had to change positions because I wasn't too relaxed in the tub. And then I wanted to try the gas. I didn't try that last time. No one even mentioned it. And the gas was amazing because then I'd started. It was so amazing.
Do you love it?
I loved it. Some people hate it. I don't know if it was the gas or the combination. I started like my doula was like, you have to breathe very deep and then breathe into it, breathe very deeply out. And it was triggering my Joe Dispenza meditation technique. And I had these full body shivers in the contraction, like full body, like it was so great. And I was making all these weird noises, AirPods in the whole time. I didn't want to like communicate really. And at one point I took them out and I looked at my husband. I was like, if I'm making weird noises and I'm concentrating so you won't see me react. And I was like, I'm really loving this. I was like, this is one of the best feelings my body has ever. I am so relaxed. I'm so happy. There are so many endorphins. I was
ecstatic. That's making me think like, along the lines of like orgasmic birth.
I know, like I would call it orgasmic, but it's not the same as like a sexual orgasm. It's like this full body.
Yeah, I've heard it's a little different.
It's different.
That's
so
cool.
It was amazing. And it was just, it was this exact same as Joe, like when I was doing my meditations at home, but just amplified. Because I think, you know, I was breathing so heavily for so long. And then with the gas and everything, it was insane. It was so great. Then I had to get out for a bit, labor outside of the tub. My doula wanted me to just get gravity because it was taking a lot longer. They thought the baby would be there by 3 o'clock. I got there around 1 because I was just progressing so fast and I was managing so well and I was in very active, like my contractions were very strong. And it was taking a bit longer than they thought. Afterwards, we found out she was posterior. We didn't know at the time, which just, it took her a little longer. And they kept having to check me because her heart rate, they thought she was asleep. I'm pretty sure she was asleep. I don't think she woke up for much of that birth. That girl was so chilled and she is still very chilled. So during that time, they kept having to do checks. And in one of the podcasts I listened to about medical birth, they said, you can say, because the monitoring is really for the hospital if something goes wrong. And there's no real research that shows that it has a positive outcome on the baby. So I eventually just said, you can record that I declined your suggestion of monitoring. And my doula just found that hysterical. So I was like, you can record that I said no. Like, you did your job. I said no. You can record it. I'll sign whatever you want. But I'm loving this birth and you are really messing with my like happy hormones. Because every time someone interrupts me, it's sore and I get overwhelmed. And I was also like, if you want me to have a C-section, you need to say it and we need to do that. Because I'm not, if my baby's in danger, you need to communicate that because then we need to change plan. but I'm getting irritated that you keep checking me. Anyway, so luckily my doula knows her. She's very kind, and she made a real effort to stay away. And then eventually the doctor came in, and the doctor said she's just not happy with the baby's just sleeping through this, and she's not happy and she wants to get out fast. So then I had to kind of purple push. But luckily it was unmedicated, so I could feel where to push. That part I wouldn't say was my favorite. That was very overwhelming, and it was sore, and it wasn't natural. But we needed to get her out, and I was like, it's fine. And when she came out, she didn't breathe. So we gave her a little bit of time. Tried breathing on her, like putting my gynecologist, she's very open to my crazy, which I don't find crazy, but doctors generally find it crazy. And she gave it as much time, and then they had to take her and just put on a little bit of oxygen. She stayed in the room, and then the NICU nurse was there, and eventually they cleared her, luckily, and she could come back. And then we breastfed. It was just, so the second birth was just unbelievable, and the recovery has been so much better. So yeah, I'm so grateful for my whole process.
Oh, that's amazing. So yeah, I was going to say then this postpartum and this physical recovery, because you had to go in for a procedure for your bladder before, and that's a lot too. So physically, probably this one hopefully has been better.
I realized the other day, because you forget, you know, and you also, I'm so busy with the two kids now that you don't really focus. And I realized by my 6-week appointment last time, I was telling my doctor I was struggling to empty my bladder, and she said that could be normal. And I had to go for pelvic floor therapy for months and months, and it wasn't really improving. So eventually I was sent to a urologist, and we had to do a little surgery just to, I think, open the urethra, I think. So it's like a small procedure, but it was a big deal because I was breastfeeding and I was a bit overwhelmed, and now it's yet another procedure. But anyway, and I had to go on medicine, but then the moment I felt pregnant, I had to stop the medication. So I was quite nervous because then my bladder was so bad in pregnancy, because I have an overactive bladder that was now damaged. And it's actually completely fine now. So I'm not even on the medication now. And I only realized that like recently. I was like, oh, my bladder is fine. I don't have the same, I haven't thought about it. Yeah. No, I could exercise. Like I think 2 weeks later, I could start pelvic floor, like exercises at home and walk. And I've done some like short runs. It's been a very different recovery, which has been nice. I think just because I could feel what I was doing.
Oh, for sure. That makes a big difference. And all of that goes into it. I know sometimes women who have experienced loss, they can get, I don't know if pressured is the right word, but the sentiment of what you were saying, I just want the baby in my arms, and they'll do whatever the doctors are saying. And so I'm really proud of you for still advocating for yourself and looking at all your options. So did the doctors that you interviewed, did they really go over the risks of a subsequent surgery?
I was so frustrated with that, because not a single one of them would tell me that I'm risking my baby's life. They would tell me it's 9% chance of uterine rupture without even giving me any medical facts or research behind it. But not a single one said how risky it is to have repeat C-sections. And I've already had one surgery, so now add another C-section. How many children do you want? I only wanted two, but that's 3 surgeries on my uterus, and everything subsequently becomes, it's actually more risky from my research to have repeat C-sections than it is to have a VBAC or a VBAM. It's way less risky on your body and your uterus. But not a single one of them said that, which just frustrated me that there's like a bit of like a C-section culture in South Africa in private hospitals where it's just the norm. And I do have grace for doctors, because I don't think any of them are trained in natural birth. They trained in saving the baby, and they trained in C-sections, and they trained in the interventions, but I think the interventions often are causing the problems. So it's a little bit of like a loop in South Africa, and I know in the US as well.
But do private hospitals also have midwives on the team at those hospitals typically?
I think, yeah. So there's definitely a midwife. No one's ever used the word midwife. They're usually nurse. There's some nurse on call, or maybe I'm just in labor land and I don't really focus on it, but it's not very midwife. The midwives are generally, you do have midwives in hospital, but the midwives are more the home birth community. And there's an amazing one, but I just couldn't use her. But it's home birth is hard to do, and it actually in a lot of times it costs you more. Like my hospital births are completely covered. The epidural, everything is completely covered where the home birth isn't. So, and then if you get transferred, then you have two births. So it's actually almost more expensive if you are on medical aid to go that route.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Well, we would love for you to send over some of those stats that Mabel gave for you, and we will attach them in the show notes, information, even stuff on the breathing. I'm so intrigued by that.
Yes.
And I love that you went over also within the myomectomy and wanting a vaginal birth after that, like the different criteria, I guess, or different types and things to look for, things like you said that you can do to lessen your chances or your risks of a uterine rupture, just like with VBAC, we know things like spontaneous labor, trying to avoid Pitocin, a lot of those things are parallel. So I love that you went to a VBAC friendly doctor too. I think that's such a good metric for like birth in general. If you want physiological birth, just look for somebody who's VBAC friendly. And that's usually a good metric. Well, wonderful. Just before we close, do you have any lasting tips or thoughts that you want to share with our community?
Tip-wise, for me, what just really worked was educating myself fully. I think having a doula is a complete game changer. Even if you do end up in C-section, and I think researching the actual hospital is really important, because my original gynecologist said, even if he okayed the things I was requesting, the hospital would constantly be giving me pushback. Important for you to find a hospital where that's just commonplace, so that you're not constantly up against, you're not constantly fighting people. And then just mentally preparing, being completely informed, and like really advocating for yourself and learning the language of how to decline certain things without being aggressive, if that makes sense. Like working with people, but like working within your own rights.
I love that. Using even just the word decline versus refuse. I love how you mentioned you can put this on record that I'm releasing you of the liability, because that is what they are afraid of. So I thought that was a beautiful way, mid-labor, that you said that. So composed. And I really love all that. And having your research book to carrying with you to appointments, and you hopefully won't need it. That's what we hope for. But then if you do, you have it. I think it builds some trust within your provider that they know you have done the work and they trust you, that you understand what you want. And then I think that creates a very special trusting relationship too. So,
yes, I think it's just goes to informed consent, where the doctor understands that I understand if I say I want to do this and something goes wrong, I'm not going to come to her and say, oh, it's your fault. And those were definitely my decisions, and it was decisions made, an educated decision. And I said to her in birth, we discuss, you know, we have to see how the birth goes. And then we discuss, if you say we need a C-section, then tell me why. And then we can say yes or no. And I think when you're the girl with the folder, the doctor is less likely to try and convince you of something that's untrue. Where if you just kind of, oh, I'll do whatever the doctor says, then you'll probably also be the girl that gets told that her baby's too big. A friend of mine had her gynae said, no, your baby's too big, we have to do a C-section. And she had to run out and get prem clothes for like premature clothes because the baby was so small. So I think it's important to know when to ask the right questions so that you can get the birth. It also depends what birth you want, because if you want an elective C-section, a lot of my friends would prefer that. And then that's power to you. If that's what you want, then I think every woman has the right to birth her baby the way she wants. I don't like it when the doctors kind of insert themselves unnecessarily and you don't get the birth that you want.
Or with the fear-mongering and the untrue statistics to push that on you if, yeah, exactly.
To scare you. No one wants a dead baby. That's not what anyone is aiming for, yeah.
And especially a lost mom, like someone who's gone through loss. Yes. Like, of course. You know, so I also love how you shed light on some empathetic ways that we can hold space for our lost moms. And Lily, she's very open about the losses that she's experienced. And I was talking to her actually this week about a friend who went through an ectopic pregnancy. And I was like, Lily, oh, I know that you went that. You're so open. How can I support her? And so she gave me just some beautiful advice. And she said, It's interesting speaking about it because I haven't talked about it in a long time. Looking back at that time period, and I don't know if you can relate, but it brings up those tender feelings. And then now having her two babies, it's just a sentiment of how much more meaningful all the little things are. The sleepless nights, you wake up with your baby and you just love them so much. And
you're just so grateful.
It's a joy. Yeah, it's a gratitude in a different way.
Yes, I've had a lot of people make comments about, you know, the journey. I remember I was at a dinner once and friends of a family member who I had obviously never spoken to about our struggles, but obviously this family member had been quite open about my struggles with them. They looked at me and they said, but my husband and I really just need to enjoy this life as they have three children, because having children is really hard. And like, you should just really enjoy this life as. And I was like, sweetheart, I'm sorry you're finding, I understand. I have two children. I understand that having children is a hardship in some ways. But I can tell you, infertility and having dead children in your body is way harder than having children, or at least for me. That you cannot tell me what I'm experiencing now with two children is a hardship. This is not a hardship. Right. This is the greatest joy
time
of my life. I will pick that every day over infertility. So I think people are just uninformed sometimes. Or you appreciate it maybe a lot more when you've experienced loss. Maybe that's just the difference.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your whole story, the whole journey, being so open. I know that your story is going to touch so many women, especially ones who are just like you, looking to find stories and aren't finding a lot. So thank you again so much. And in honor of Mag's episode today, we have a new blog that we're going to be posting on our website all about VBAC after myomectomy, with the stats that Mag's talked about, the different types of that kind of procedure, and how to find a supportive provider, just all that good stuff. So thank you again for joining us. It was such a pleasure to have you today.
Thank you so much. Oh, it was so great. Thank you so much for having me.
Would you like to be a guest on the podcast? Head over to thevbaclink.com/share to submit your story. For information on all things VBAC, including online and in-person VBAC classes, the VBAC blog, the worldwide database for VBAC doulas, and more, head over to thevbaclink.com. Congratulations on starting your journey of learning and discovery with the VBAC Link.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode and for being a part of our community. One of my favorite parts of the VBAC Link is the community itself. When I was pregnant and planning for a VBA 2C, the VBAC Link community group on Facebook truly became a virtual village for me. It's where I could see real VBAC stories, ask questions without judgment, and get encouragement from people who genuinely understood what I was preparing for. If you are planning a VBAC and want support as you get ready, head over to Facebook and search the VBAC Link community, because women of strength become even stronger together.